Morning, everyone. This morning's reading is into Genesis we are today. So Genesis chapter 11, verses 1 to 9. Now the whole world had one language and a common speech. As people moved eastward, they found a plain in Shinar and settled there. They said to each other, "Come, let's make bricks and bake them thoroughly." They used brick instead of stone and tar for mortar. Then they said, "Come, let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens so that we may make a name for ourselves. Otherwise, we will be scattered over the face of the whole earth." But the Lord came down to see the city and the tower the people were building. The Lord said, "If as one people speaking the same language they have begun to do this, then nothing they plan to do will be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and confuse their language so they will not understand each other." So the Lord scattered them from there over all the earth, and they stopped building the city. That is why it was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of the whole world. From there the Lord scattered them over the face of the whole earth.
Good morning, everyone. So we're into our second week of the Greater Than series, and we're carrying on from Andrew talking about naturalism. How as Christians, do we engage with that worldview of naturalism? And today we're talking about humanism. I found out that there was, this week, a momentous event will take place. The Earth, at some point this week, will reach 8 billion people. This week. 8 billion human beings spread across continents and nations and tribes and languages. Some right now are on the other side of the world, partying or enjoying festivals. Some are fighting each other in wars. Some are giving birth. Some are watching loved ones die. Some are loving. Some are hurting other humans. Some are bringing redemption and beauty into the world. 8 billion humans just living their lives, and all of them are asking at some point, before they return again to the dust that they came from, what does it mean to be human? It's one of the essential questions that we all ask, and there are so many possible avenues to get an answer to that question. What does it mean to be human? A plethora of world religions, spiritualities, and philosophies. But for us here in Australia, in a very secular society, the philosophy that people will go to in order to have that question answered most of the time is humanism, and specifically secular humanism. There's a whole ton of different types of humanism, but this one is secular humanism. What is it? Do I need to change mic? It's a little bit... I'll just grab that.
Cool. Got me? Hey, ha, that's nice. All right. So the best way to find a description for secular humanism is by looking at the humanist manifestos. There's three of those. They kind of outline the main principles of humanism. And this is a little bit of an excerpt from one of them. It says, "No deity will save us. We must save ourselves. We are responsible for what we are and what we will be." That worldview, secular humanism, has so penetrated our society that this is the dominant worldview that most people have, but they don't even know it. That's how you know how deeply ingrained a worldview is. It's whether or not people are aware of it. And this says, there's no God. Of course, no God. I'm thinking about all my neighbours in Kurnell who I speak to. This is their thing, right? This is their philosophy. There's no God. God is not going to help you. There's nothing beyond this world to help you. So the only way that you're going to get any meaning in your life is through being the best human you can be. And make your own meaning by doing that. The main story, because every worldview has a story that it wants you to kind of believe and live into and see your story as part of its big story. The story of secular humanism is progress. Progress. Progress in the story of secular humanism is like it's the engine that drives history forward. You can see this is a helpful graphic from a guy called Mark Sayers. Where we are now, progress is taking us forward as civilization until we reach a human utopia at the end of all things. And the way that we actually progress as a society and as a person, the way that you progress is by getting rid of religion and faith and all that superstition. Just like jettison that out of your life, get rid of it. We need to get it out of us, our bloodstream as a society. And then once we do that, we will be able to progress to this future utopia. That's the thing that drives secular humanism forward, progress. That we can do it as human beings. We can get ourselves there as long as we get rid of religion, faith, and superstition. You see this kind of coming out in pop culture all over the place. Like every science fiction movie has this like idea of things are not good now, but in the end they will be. We'll be able to like through our knowledge and supreme intellect and our technological like abilities, we'll be able to make a reality all of our dreams, all of our imaginations. And this is the assumed kind of worldview that most people you brush up against are believing. But there's doubt in it. There's doubt. It's actually not that hard to pop the bubble of secular humanism. It's as simple as asking a question like, if progress is the main thing driving human history forward, are we actually progressing as humans? In some ways we are. We are more affluent globally. We are more technologically connected. Our scientific knowledge has increased. There are lower levels of poverty. We've been able to establish things like the Declaration of Human Rights, although most of that came from Christianity. And humanism's built on top of that. We are starting to care for climate action, which no matter what your ideas are about that, Christians should like care about. We steward the environment. So we're progressing in that sense, but our failures are very resilient still. Even though we seem to have progressed across thousands of years, our failures are resilient. There's still corruption. There's tribalism. Some people call this age the age of genocide. There's economic inequality. There are wars being fought as we speak in places that we never thought they would be fought. But also there's personal doubt, not just like on a large scale, global scale, but people are personally doubting this whole philosophy. Global sadness is increasing. People are just generally more sad. I read a report by Gallup this week that suggested that. People are just sadder. There's low levels of emotional health. There's addictions so prevalent in our society because of the anxiety that we feel. We're trying to self-medicate out this sense of things should be going well, We're supposed to have it in ourselves as humans to progress, but why is my life just sucking right now? Why are things not going well? And so we're addicted to gambling and porn and alcohol and relationships in order to numb that pain. So in summary, there is, no matter how beautiful this seems, there's a major doubt lurking in the soul of every person who ascribes to this worldview. And if they're doubting that worldview, then that means deep down, we're doubting our own ability to save ourselves. We're doubting the fact that we alone are responsible for what we are and who we will be. And therefore, there's a tendency for the human being to reach out to something beyond themselves. And this is where Christianity enters in. Christianity, like secular humanism, sees a future hope. That we are going somewhere. History has an end. We're going there, right? There's an eternal future. It's the destiny of all of us. But the difference between humanism and Christianity is that we believe that progress, human progress, can't get you there. Human progress cannot get us to the future that God has for us. We need presence. We need the presence of God. The same presence that started everything at the beginning, who walked in the cool of the garden with Adam and Eve. God's presence with them made Adam and Eve fully human for that one beautiful fleeting moment. God's presence with Jesus made him fully human, allowed him to reach his fullest potential as a human being. We need presence. Our churches need presence. Every human being on the planet needs presence. God's presence is the engine driving history forward towards his end. But in secular society, secular humanism, progress has replaced presence. And it's a thing that we do as humans, and we've done it even from the beginning. We have a tendency to just be like, we cast out God's presence and we say, we can do it ourselves. We're good enough to do it ourselves. We see this in the Genesis chapter 11, in the story of the Tower of Babel. You could say that these early humans are like the first humanists, right? At the beginning of the chapter, it says that the whole world had one language and a common speech. So this is like a monolithic people, not far removed from the first human beings. And this is happening after the flood. So God saves Noah and his family from the flood, and it's like a new start. He's like, go forth and multiply. You know, I'm going to go with you. We can do this, populate the earth. And then it doesn't take long for them all to go, actually, we don't need God. They're just repeating the same mistake again that led to the flood. We don't need the presence. We'll take matters into our own hands. We'll save ourselves. So these are like the first humanists. And they say, come, let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens so that we may make a name for ourselves. You can see that there's this basic insecurity there amidst these first humans. It's the same insecurity that we all have. It's in you. It's in me. It's in the elites like Mark Zuckerberg and the Elon Musks. It's this insecurity that drives us, the desire to be significant. And most of the time, be significant in the eyes of other people. And that drives us to want to just jettison out the presence of God and be a somebody in and of ourselves to try to be like God. And like the amazing thing is, because of the Creator's stamp on us as people, we can achieve significant things. We can do amazing things. We can progress to a point because God's wired us that way. But it will never work sustainably without the presence of God. And that's what this story kind of shows. There's a lot of irony in it. In the text, it says that these first humans who were so like wise and amazing and so like confident in their own abilities, they use brick to build their city and the tower instead of stone, which is meant to like show how fragile the thing was. And then there's this moment where God is like in the heavens, and he chooses to come down to check out this tower, because the tower is meant to reach the heavens, right? The best project that humanity has ever undertaken. And God has to come down, and the emphasis is on like God having to come down to see it. It's almost as if like he has to stoop down, like when my kids build a sandcastle on the beach and they're like so proud of it, and I have to stoop down. I'm like, oh right, yeah, that's great. So God's kind of like, he's like looking down from heaven, and he's like, there's a tower there? Oh, there it is, that's great. Good job, guys. It's this kind of like this kind of mockery of the insignificance of humanity's greatest achievement that God has. And the story finishes with God putting an end to the whole project. Not out of a sense of envy, of like, whoa, if these guys can build a tower like that, nothing can stop them. It's more that it's an act of grace. He's thinking, they're just going to keep doing this. They're going to keep trying to progress as humanity without my presence. And that is not good for them. That's going to derail the entire plan that I have for the world. And so as an act of grace, he confuses their language. And that's obviously the origin story in the Bible for the different languages across the world. And then they abandon the project because they don't speak one language anymore, and it's left half finished. And actually, Babel, throughout the Old Testament, that word for Babel is in every other place translated as Babylon. And Babylon in the Bible is a symbol for every civilization that embraces a humanist vision in an attempt to enthrone itself. And God always comes up against Babylon. And we see this continue for thousands of years. Humanity just keeps trying to build the Tower of Babel in all these different ways, right? In all these massive projects, in empires, in art. The church was at one point like this massive human project in the Catholic Church before the Reformation. Even recently, around the year 2011, it looked as though humanity had rebuilt the Tower of Babel. Facebook had actually achieved something that had never been achieved before. It had interconnected the entire globe through this shared space of relationship that had never been done before. So it's almost as if we were like one people, and everybody had an iPhone in their hand suddenly. Everyone was so connected, and then Google Translate came out. And Google Translate, it's like essentially we're all like able to understand each other in theory. A guy in the Atlantic newspaper in America wrote about this time. He said, "We were closer than we had ever been to being one people. And we had effectively overcome the curse of division by language. It seemed to be only the beginning of what humanity could do." So it was this massive achievement this modern Tower of Babel, and it united us until it didn't unite us anymore. Because since then, it's just been riddled with algorithms that have created like this sense of total fragmentation and tribalism and confirmation bias and echo chambers where we just can't understand each other anymore. And it's literally like serving to rip societies apart. It's almost as if God kind of saw the Tower of Babel rising and put a stop to it. You could actually make a case that whenever God sees a humanist Babel arise, he brings it down. In his sovereignty, in his power, the one who sees the beginning from the end, he's constantly putting an end to empires and movements as an act of grace so that we might know that we can't do anything without his presence. We can't progress in and of ourselves. We can't save ourselves. This is his world. It's his story, his plan. But these Babels keep coming, driven by that same insecurity to be significant, to find meaning. And for us, it's the same on a personal level. When we're asking these questions as human beings, like, who am I? Am I significant? And in order to deal with that question, that insecurity, we build our own Babels, fueled by that insecurity for meaning and purpose and to be seen and loved. Our very lives become projects that we hope are going to save us and give us meaning. And maybe if we're selfless enough, they're going to contribute, our life projects are going to contribute to the betterment of humanity, which is the ideal of humanism. But usually that's not the case. We're too selfish. This is our lives are project self. We make our own meaning. I wonder if you think about your life, are you trying to progress in your own strength? Are you trying to build a Babel out of your life so that others may see you and acknowledge you and say you're significant? We do it in heaps of ways, whether it's a perfectly curated social media profile. Look at me, look at my life, my project self. Whether it's an incredible asset portfolio of stocks and bonds, whatever it is, God still kind of looks at the greatest thing of your life that you get all this meaning from. And no matter how grand we think it is, God has to stoop down to see it. It's fragile. Our lives are fragile. Humanism says, so there's no God? So what? Make your own meaning. But people like C.S. Lewis have said, like, you can get meaning out of things in your life, for sure. But if you don't have a larger meaning than that, something outside of yourself, that when suffering comes, the meaninglessness of everything will break in on you and you'll feel your insignificance. If we go by the philosophy of humanism, it says there's no God, make your own meaning, just be the best human you can be, one day you'll realize that nothing in your life has any intrinsic meaning or value, because we're all accidents here. Not even your family, not our time in history that we live, even the entire history of civilization, in the end, will just be like a flicker amidst the oceans of dead time that came before and will come after. And you might think, well, I'm a Christian. That's fair enough for everybody else who believes in that philosophy. I'm a Christian, I don't believe in that. I'm not a secular humanist. But even Christians make their own Babels all the time. And no matter what you might say about your faith, if you're living to progress in your own strength, in your own energy, through your own strategy, your own plan, you might be theoretically a Christian by title, but actually you're functionally more like a secular humanist because you're just living your own life, your way. And you've pushed out the present and replaced it for your own ability to progress. Just look at your life now. How many times in a day are you aware of the presence of God animating you and enabling you to live for His purposes? If there's no presence in your life, the only thing that's left is a prideful belief that you're enough. And this is the reality. God sees that if we keep thinking that we're responsible for what we are and who we will be, we're not going to progress at all. We're not going to achieve any breakthroughs or arrive at anything significant. We'll get pulled into what's called the cycle of zero progress. It's a pride-shame cycle that you enter into, and millions of people in the world who are meant to be progressing, who are trying to live their lives, get sucked into this cycle. It happens when you believe you can do it all yourself. It starts off with pride as a human being, thinking that you don't need God, you can do it yourself. And you say something like, I can totally do this. I can do it. And then you move into the shame part of the cycle. And you go, it's getting hard. I thought I could do it. It's getting hard. And then you go, oh no, it's all falling apart. I thought I could get this done. I thought I could break this addiction. Then you get to the pit of shame. Nothing I do ever works. And there's so many people in that place. Then you move out back into the pride part of the cycle. What's the point anyway? Like, what's the point? If I can't do it, then what's the point? And then you think in your pridefulness, but if I don't, who? There's no one outside of me to help myself. It's just me. So if I don't do it, who will? And then it starts all over again. I can totally do this. Then you move into shame and pride and shame and pride over and over again. I've been there. I've been stuck in the middle of that cycle. And it's not until you get on your knees and plead with God for His presence are you able to break out of that. Only the presence can break the cycle of pride and shame. And that's the answer for us as Christians. We can engage with this philosophy in incredible ways and be aware of it, but unless we are people of the presence and not people who try to do everything ourselves, and try to progress as an individual or as a community, then we just talk. There's a sequel to Babel in the Bible. It's in Acts chapter 2. Jesus' disciples are in the upper room, and they're there, they're waiting. They're not trying to do it all themselves. They're listening to Jesus' command to wait for Him until the helper comes. And God looks at them and He goes, okay, you want to build something beautiful? You want significance? Have My presence. And He pours His presence on His people. It's His full resolution to Babel. He pours out His presence just like it had been in Eden. And then Peter gets up at the festival of Pentecost, and pretty much every nation is there in the city, and Peter starts talking, and suddenly they all hear him again. Like there's one language once more. God is saying as he did that, I am the engine driving history to its end. You want to be part of something world-changing? You want to have breakthrough in your life and meaning? You want to know what it means to be human? You need my presence, my energy, my strength. And with me, we can build for my kingdom. We're going to take communion together now. I'll give you a few moments. We'll rip off the seal. Thanks. Something like secular humanism, which is so pervasive in our world, essentially says, your best is enough. Be the best human you can be. Your best is enough. But I think about what my best is. My best effort, most of the time, falls completely flat. It is infinitesimal. It is tiny when you think about the broad scope of this world and the 8 billion people who live in it. My best is not enough. My best takes me to the cycle of pride and shame. I don't know if you're the same in that. But God's best is infinite. It has no end. It is so far-reaching. It is an ocean of power and majesty. God's best is incredible. And when God offers to us his presence, he's saying, take my best. Have my best effort at your disposal. And right now, this meal is a time to remember the fact that God has given us his best as Christians to take hold of and to work for his kingdom and to find real meaning and significance. And the whole reason that we have God's presence is because of Jesus. Jesus is God's best effort. And the reason why Jesus came is because whatever we can do as humans is not enough. It will never be enough. Jesus died, he gave up his life so that we might see what it means to be fully human and to experience the grace and mercy of God and to be part of something that is beyond ourselves. So let's hold the elements in our hands together. Let's take a moment to thank God for the gift of his powerful presence in our lives. And to thank him that though we have said things like, we don't need you, God. We can save ourselves. To say something as prideful as that, God still loves us. He sees us as significant. He calls us his own, and he would give his life that we might know him. So we take his bread, which represents Jesus's body broken for us, to give us real meaning and purpose and significance. Let's take the bread together. We take this drink, which reminds us of Jesus' blood poured out for the sin and pride of all of humanity. And when you think about the 8 billion people that are about to populate this planet, this is the only thing that can save, the only thing that can bring true significance. So let's drink and be grateful together. Jesus, we see you. We feel your presence, Lord. Thank you that we're not just here in a room talking to ourselves. You are here, Lord, and we need you. Every moment we need you, every second we need you. We praise you, God, that you are with us. And through you, Lord, we can break through, we can progress and be aligned with your will for our lives. And we can experience the joy and significance of what it means to be in the presence of a holy God. And we think one day, Lord, and we rejoice that there is an end to all things. And it's not something that we're going to bring about. It's something that you will ultimately bring about in the end. And you will renew all things, God. And every eye will see you and tongue confess that you are Lord. And we will know our purpose as people who have life on this earth. Thank you, God. In these moments, just continue to be with us, Lord, and minister to us. May we be grateful for who you are and what you've done for us. In Jesus' name, amen.